Okay, well, I'm delighted to introduce Derek Dreyer, who is director of the Rosenbach Museum and Library, and who was previously curator there. And in fact, he tells me he had some ambivalence about the move from being curator with all the hands-on work to becoming director, which, of course, involves a huge amount of administration. But he's done a phenomenal job, I think. Derek was a Fulbright scholar and was awarded a Kress Fellowship for research in Germany. And his research has focused upon Renaissance drawings, which led to the 2005 exhibition of two albums of the drawings of Girolamo da Capio. Like James, Derek has played an active role in the collaborative work of Philadelphia libraries and is at present chair of PACSCoL, the Philadelphia Area Consortium of Special Collections of Libraries. He's also collaborated extensively with Penn, as on the recent exhibition curated by David Stern on Philadelphia's Great Hebraica, and on exhibitions like Making Shakespeare in 2002, curated by a former Penn graduate student, Jack Lynch. Please join me in welcoming Derek, who will be talking today about On Private Collections and Public Libraries, Dr. A.S.W. Rosenbach and John Frederick Lewis.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, James, for paving the road for me. I sense the reluctance to ask and answer questions may come from the new knowledge that this is all being recorded. So everybody's suddenly behaving. Well, that happens sometimes. Philadelphia is a city that has spent more time ruminating about collections it has lost. One thinks of Rosenwald and Widener, and I'm grateful to James for illuminating both sides of the Widener history there, than celebrating ones it has preserved. I can tell you this is a city replete with collections and with remarkable ones at that. And it's a city in which there is still field work to be done. Many collections not known at all or not known in the way that they should be. I will be speaking today about a collector who is reasonably well known, John Frederick Lewis, and his collection, which itself is now much better known thanks to the digital scriptorium and the efforts of some of those present today. Similarly, I will be speaking about a dealer of rare books and manuscripts who was quite well known in his day, but whose legacy has been forgotten, I think not in this room and not in the book circle, but generally speaking, his role has not been recognized the way it should be. What attracted me to these two was the extent to which they worked together and collaborated on building a collection. And as James was careful to note, Lewis did not acquire all of his manuscripts from Dr. Rosenbach, but a great many of them. I've often looked at Philadelphia as a city in which the proverbial 6 degrees of separation have never applied. It seems there's usually only one or two. It's so easy to connect people. And Lewis and Rosenbach are remarkably, inextricably connected. And there are a number of transactions that I've looked at that weren't even at arm's length, and which I think would be questioned in modern times. Who was Dr. Rosenbach? Who was the Lewis behind most of the thousands of manuscripts at the Free Library? To complete this paper, I have delved not into the manuscripts themselves, but into the archives. I'm going to show you a lot of very ugly, fuzzy images of carbon copies of typed letters. I'm not going to show you beautiful manuscripts. I'm comfortable doing that because the beautiful manuscripts are on display for you, at least a selection of them over at the Arthur Ross Gallery, and of course all of them are available at the Free Library. Historians love to study probate records, and you can imagine the interesting kinds of facts that would come out of a study of the various appraisals of Lewis's estate, not just the manuscripts that went to the Free Library, but his entire estate, which we have. And that's not even taking into consideration the bulk of Lewis's papers, which are preserved at the American Philosophical Society and the University of Delaware. When you consider that we at the Rosenbach preserve not just Lewis's correspondence, the relevant records that bear out his activity as a customer, but those of every customer and every person associated with the Rosenbach Company over its 50-year history. You can imagine how much still remains to be done. In preparing this paper, I have relied not just on the archival accounts available to me in my own museum collection, but on the oral accounts of one of John Frederick Lewis's grandsons, Howard Lewis, who, like his grandfather, is a prominent attorney in Philadelphia. Though he never met his grandfather, the lore passed down to Howard through his father, who became one of Dr. Rosenbach's close friends, is knowledge that he has cherished and carried with him for decades now. I'm deeply grateful to him for sharing his knowledge with me so freely, and I might say so frankly and objectively. He was willing to ask lots of questions about this legacy. As I said, my focus is not going to be on the individual treasures that Lewis amassed and their various art historical, literary, or liturgical aspects. My focus is on the mode of collecting, the motivations behind it, and the transformation of a private collection into a public library. Now I have to figure out this remote. I'm failing test number one. Oh, there we go. Lewis right here. I want to start, this is Lewis's residence at 1914 Spruce, as it appears now. This is Dr. Rosenbach, contemporary photo, and I'm going to start by talking a bit about him. I'm going to consider, to a much lesser extent, his brother. His older brother was a specialist in fine and decorative arts. He probably sold more things through the Rosenbach Company than his brother did, but his brother sold the more notable things, and he's the one who tends to be remembered today. This was their house at 2006 Delancey Place. The museum has since moved. I won't get into that story. You see an X in that photo taken in 1912. I did not put the X there. This is a mark in a book for which I am not responsible. But for those of you not from Philadelphia, those two residences are about 50 yards apart as the crow flies. And this is the phenomenon in which I'm interested. These are some of Lewis's customer cards that we preserve in our archives. Back to Dr. Rosenbach. He was a Penn PhD, speaking of Penn students, who had a nutty idea that he should open a shop selling rare books and manuscripts, and that he should do so together with his brother Philip, whose picture you've seen, who was a specialist, as I said, in fine and decorative arts. Philip had bankrolled the doctor's education. He was not sure this was a good idea, and he was not sure he should bankroll anything else. But the business began. It began quite slowly until another person, whose name has been mentioned already this morning, happened into the shop, and that was Harry Elkins Widener. Widener has been described in connection with Harvard, but of course it was a Philadelphia family. Harry spent his summers and other breaks away from Harvard in Philadelphia. He found when he entered the store of the Rosenbach Company that the doctor spoke to him not in a fawning way that he was already accustomed to because of his wealth, but in an excited way, the way he would speak to a kindred spirit. The doctor had so much enthusiasm and passion for collecting. He had this notion that if you collected manuscripts in particular, and whether historical or literary or art historical didn't really matter, the point was you had something that was handwritten. It didn't exist in exactly that form anywhere else. And his notion was if you collected one, two, three, four of these things, you could start to rearrange the order. You could start to interpret those things yourself, and that you as a collector could then write the history books. And he made it very compelling to his customers that this was a privilege that in the past only kings and princes in Europe had had. But now you, the collector, could do this. Harry loved that idea. and Harry began collecting English rare books. And it's one of the more touching pieces of correspondence we preserve that Harry wrote to the doctor from London in 1912 saying, in essence, "I've finally found the Bacon Essays of 1598 that I've been chasing for so long, and I can't wait to show you my treasure. My family and I sail home in 3 weeks on a new boat called the Titanic." So, of course, Harry didn't make it, and Harry's father did not make it. The Bacon Essays did not make it, I'm sorry to say, but Mrs. Widener got a spot in the lifeboat. She contacted Dr. Rosenbach later that year and basically said to him, "I understand that my son was building a library. That will be my memorial to him. You finish the job." And she made it clear that it was speed that mattered, not cost. And this is every book dealer's dream. Dr. Rosenbach spent upwards of $100,000 in the first month of this commission. This is 1912. And I can assure you, you could buy some pretty tasty things for that money now. Not a whole library, but some nice things. This went on for about a year, and that formed the core of the Widener Library at Harvard. More important for Dr. Rosenbach, it set up a model that others with essentially limitless wealth gladly followed. They saw him not as a dealer who had some purely mercantile relationship, but as an advisor, as a friend. This was someone who was going to help them build a library. This was happening in the teens. It was happening in increased measure after the end of World War I. Many, many manuscripts and other objects of art were wandering out of European collections and into American collections. There was a sea change that started to take place. You could do research in a way you couldn't previously in this country. You could build collections in a way you couldn't previously in this country. And people like Morgan and Frick and Folger and Huntington were among those who responded to this call and built libraries with the help of Dr. Rosenbach. His role, as I said earlier, has been eclipsed today, but those are still the libraries that we think of as some of America's great research libraries. Dr. Rosenbach went on to have a career that was characterized by buying and selling activities we can only describe as swashbuckling, piratical, sometimes slightly unethical. One of the things that he clung to, though, in all of the work he did was the public responsibility of private collectors. Just to give you a single example, in 1928, the manuscript for Alice's Adventures in Wonderland went on sale in London. Charles Dodgson had actually prepared a handwritten version of his story and given it to the little girl, Alice, who was featured in it. She kept it for most of her life, but for tax reasons had to sell it in 1928, and the doctor was there and was ready to buy it. And when other buyers dropped out, he kept going. It often didn't matter to him that he paid more than he needed to. He used that as a marketing tool. He paid about $75,000 for that manuscript. This is December 1928, several months before the Depression came, and his business was already highly leveraged. Had he not found a buyer, he would have been in great trouble, and he did not have a buyer when he bought the manuscript. But within a month of returning, he sold it to Eldridge Johnson in Camden, the heir to the RCA Victor fortune. Johnson was willing to pay 100% profit on his purchase. So it was quite some purchase. Do you think the doctor was ready to deliver it to him? Of course not. What he said was, "Mr. Johnson, I want you to build a display case. We're going to put the manuscript inside it, and we're going to put little levers on the front of it so people can turn the pages without touching it. And we're going to put it on display at the Free Library. And then it's going to travel around the country, and then you can have it." Johnson said, "Okay." So he would do anything he could to buy low and sell high, the stockbroker's motto, but he would also do everything in his power to ensure that things that were private became public. Now I'm going to turn to Lewis. John Frederick Lewis grew up a man of modest means. He matriculated from Philadelphia's Central High School, but did not attend college because he lacked the funds to do so. His later success in life, despite this fact, seems to have remained a point not of pride, but of shame for him. Lewis found a patron in the person of George Dallas, a prominent maritime lawyer who tutored him in this subject. Maritime law, which is concerned with import and export, collisions of ships, contracts of sailors, just about everything except shipbuilding, is a practice that is not really practiced anymore, but Philadelphia used to be one of the great capitals of maritime law. With the assistance of Dallas, Lewis developed a deep understanding of maritime law and passed the bar exam. He never attended law school, but at the time, if you passed the bar exam, you could become a lawyer. Part of what Lewis learned as a lawyer was that lawyers could enhance their earnings by exploiting their knowledge of international trade. He and his family became wealthy initially by buying opium in China and reselling it in the Philippines. That's where the initial money comes from. Later, this trade was frowned upon, and Lewis's fortunes faltered. There's another euphemism for you. Financial salvation and more came through his marriage to Ann Baker, the heiress to the North American Insurance Company fortune, and quite a fortune it was. James mentioned already Mrs. Lewis's illness, and that's one of the reasons we almost never hear about her in all of the correspondence, which is a great shame. Overnight, Lewis became one of the richest men in Philadelphia, and just as quickly, in the words of his grandson, he became a small man with a very large ego. He wanted a manse, his word, in which to live, and to this end he acquired a 2,400-acre property in Malvern called Morstein's, now part of Immaculata College. He built a private railroad station for himself and also his own post office. He insisted on posting all of his letters from that post office, even if they were completed in the city and brought out there to be mailed. He acquired a second country estate called Homestead at Hot Springs in West Virginia, and of course the townhouse at 1914 Spruce that I showed you a moment ago was filled with art and collectibles. He was imperious. He was diffident about his wealth. Lacking the formal education that his compatriots had, he was not interested in literature. The handwritten word interested him because it showed craft. The printed word did not. Not surprisingly, then, these preferences led him to develop an interest in manuscripts. That interest played right into the hands of Dr. Rosenbach with his strong position on collecting history. And Dr. Rosenbach, in turn, played right into the hands of Lewis, who also sought to have his own personal dealer. And those of you in the business in the room, I'm sure, wish you could have a customer like that, wanted you all for themselves. Lewis began building a collection of medieval manuscripts, and he was careful to specify that he only wanted single leaves, not complete codices. I'm going to show you some of this correspondence after I finish reading the paper. He explained that his intent in acquiring single leaves was to display them at the Academy of Fine Arts, of which he was the president, not to build a library. He only wanted them for aesthetic reasons. His collection began with Western medieval documents, but slowly began to shift in favor of Eastern, what he called Oriental documents. And it was fortunate, his grandson notes, that J.P. Morgan, who was still very active at the time, was not interested in single leaves and not interested in Eastern manuscripts. Otherwise, Lewis's collection might not have come about. As it was, though, Lewis was able to buy entire sales, and he often gave instructions to do essentially that. Sometimes even noting in his letters he hadn't had the time to look at the catalog and requesting that his dealer suggest an appropriate bid. Most of the time, though, he specified the exact lots he wanted and included his bid for each. A fairly quick development was that he came to trust the advice of one particular London-based buyer for the Rosenbach Company. And his letters begin noting that bids should be executed only if this buyer is in favor of them. It's only in the final stage of his buying that his eye and his taste become highly developed, and he begins to chastise the Rosenbachs sometimes for suggesting that he purchase certain manuscripts. How did this all start? The relationship between the Rosenbach Company and John Frederick Lewis began in 1911, and it did not begin well. Lewis had been invited to write a foreword for a publication on the prints of Joseph Pennell, which was rushed to press before he had a chance to revise his text. He writes several letters to the company explaining his displeasure about this. Those initial difficulties subside, and Lewis begins buying large groups of manuscripts. He writes increasingly cordial letters, thanking them for executing his bids so well. Sometimes he thanks them for not levying any commission on the purchases, and one wonders, at least initially, how the Rosenbachs were making money if they weren't levying commissions. Lewis had a number of curious tendencies in his collecting. He used an ink pen to mark almost all of the manuscripts he bought with his full signature, and he would also apply a small blue stamp to them next to his signature, a crest with a fish on it, and the device beneath it, unbestechlich, literally unbribable. But I think what he meant by that was more figurative, sort of someone of unassailable high morals. We may regret such marks nowadays. It's a topic that, again, has come up already, although it has to be said he applied his name in the least disfiguring way possible. And the marks, were the library not still together, would make it very easy to reconstruct his libraries and aid scholars. His insistence on buying what he invariably referred to as cuttings aside, Lewis made a few purchases, more than a few purchases of complete codices, some of which are nothing short of spectacular. The Lewis Psalter has been mentioned already. As Lewis's buying spree continues, more or less unchecked for a period of years, the Rosenbach Company begins to shower him with attention. One wonders what took them so long. offering increasingly to buy things for him before he contacts them. This is a real sea change in the relationship. But he then begins to respond, as I said, with a more developed eye and sense of what he wants, and at one point assails them for offering something, noting that the description in the catalog is totally unsatisfactory and he cannot offer any bid. The relationship throughout these years, no matter what the correspondence sometimes indicates, was clearly one of great trust and great cordial nature. As Lewis became more prominent, he became involved with the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, I already mentioned, the Library Company of Philadelphia, and even the Philadelphia Zoo. He was particularly close to Pennsylvania Governor Pennypacker, and through that avenue secured the funding with which the current building of the Historical Society was erected. Lewis recognized that his associations with the city's most prominent cultural institutions and his links to great politicians would increase his influence on matters in the city. But this is something that never translated to broader popularity. He had an unsuccessful bid, for example, to become Attorney General of the state. It seems throughout his life that the links he forged with institutions, the offices he sought, were always an attempt to make up for the standing he felt he never had at the beginning of his life. The last letter from Lewis is dated January of 1932. He dies shortly thereafter, and when the correspondence picks up, it is his son, John Frederick Lewis Jr., who is beginning to request appraisals of manuscripts and of other documents. And he notes in one of the letters that they are to be transferred to the Free Library. And I can't help but think, as I reflect on that, why it was that he parted ways with the Academy. Initially, he was only buying leaves so he could display them at the Academy. Later, the Academy is not mentioned at all, at least not with respect to the manuscripts. Did he feel it wasn't appropriate for the long-term preservation of these materials? Did he think that a library should be entrusted with these things? Or Did he simply develop a stronger relationship with the library's administrators over the years? Did it play a role, for example, that Dr. Rosenbach was chairman of the Free Library at the time of his death? Whatever his reasons for favoring them, the works Lewis bequeathed to the Free Library are nothing short of a gold mine, not just for the library, but for the whole city. It's already been noted that there are some 200 Western codices, 2,000 leaves, and over 150 of what Lewis called Oriental manuscripts. And as he used that term, that also included Ethiopian, Armenian, the whole gamut. But what about the 2,800 cuneiform clay tablets and cones that he collected, most of which are now at the Penn Museum? And of course, there's the print collection that he founded at the Free Library, which now has over 200,000 prints. Lewis Jr. turned to Rosenbach repeatedly to appraise all aspects of his father's estate. And the appraisal took quite some time. Rosenbach promises Lewis in June of 1938 he would have it completed by the first week of July. But in October, Lewis asks how things are progressing. The squeaky wheel, as always, gets the oil. The appraisal was finished the next day. If that seems galling on the part of Rosenbach, the appraisal is something, the sheer size of which, I think, would impress you. And one suspects that they really were working on the last details of it. Just to give you a rundown of it, there was a full inventory of the contents of 1914 Spruce Street. That inventory runs to 68 pages and 1,600 entries. It's an inventory of the items at 1914 Spruce that were purchased by the Rosenbach Company before being sold or transferred. And here again, you'd seem to have another red flag, the appraiser and the dealer acting all at once and helping himself. An inventory of the items at Moorstein, the large country estate, that were to be sold, 38 pages, 879 entries. An inventory of items at Moorstein not to be sold, but rather retained by the estate, 11 pages, unnumbered, but hundreds of entries. And finally, an inventory of the books at Moorstein that Rosenbach wished to purchase himself, and clearly did, 3 pages, also unnumbered. And just a footnote there, none of those volumes is still in our collection. Not surprisingly, one result of this long process of appraisal, which by all accounts required frequent trips to the various estates and sumptuous meals as part of them, Dr. Rosenbach and John Frederick Lewis Jr. became great friends. Lewis insisted in his correspondence that the doctor help himself to something from the estate, and also gave Rosenbach occasional outright gifts. Lewis's grandson reports that Rosenbach would bring his own bottle of scotch to dinner parties, a trait that Lewis seems to have picked up himself. And while this seems to have offended others, they clearly thought they were right on target. Part of a lore that's been handed down to us at the Rosenbach Museum is that the doctor was a passionate fisherman, that he maintained a boat just off Strathmere in New Jersey for the purpose of fishing, bringing in fish. As Howard Lewis, John Frederick Lewis's grandson, remembers it, however, and he accompanied his father and the doctor on some of these so-called fishing trips, they had nothing to do with fishing and everything with getting offshore during Prohibition to drink. Howard recalls being chastised severely by the doctor for once actually catching a fish, and in his surprise, dropping the rod into the water. Dr. Rosenbach made his boatman jump in to get it. So Rosenbach, like Lewis Sr., could have an imperious, even a mean side. Lewis, as I mentioned, insisted on giving to the Free Library the thousands of cuneiform tablets, which the Free Library apparently did not want, and one can understand why they might not view it as appropriate to their collection. Lewis's gift was motivated not by charity, but by spite in this case. He did not want the Penn Museum to have those things. He did not like their director. Fortunately, Lewis Jr. arranged transfer of most of those items, so they're in their proper place. Scholars began to assess the new Lewis collection at the Free Library as soon as it was in place. Edwin Wolfe compiled the first catalog of the manuscripts in 1937. Do I even need to note that he worked for Dr. Rosenbach and that the doctor wrote the foreword to that catalog? This clearly seems to have been something that was rushed to get done, a rush to impress the Lewis family, a rush to impress the Free Library, which Dr. Rosenbach chaired, and Wolfe later came to regret the speed with which he prepared that volume. Almost immediately, he received a detailed letter from a German scholar with a list of corrections that should be made, and not long after, he was embarrassed to learn that something he had described as French 15th century was in fact a 20th century creation of the Spanish forger. 70 years later, you can see every single one of Lewis's illuminated manuscripts online. And the service that Lynn Ransom and her colleagues specifically, but the Free Library more generally, have performed for scholars and students around the world really can't be praised enough. And there is this final link between Lewis and Rosenbach, the Free Library ever looming large in the lives of both of the two of them. In 1947, long after Lewis's death, Dr. Rosenbach gives one of his great collections to the Free Library, his collection of early American illustrated children's books, thousands of them. He was 71 at the time, and that suggests that at that age he had not yet formed any plans to make his own collection permanent. Those documents were drawn up just years later, and both of these private collections, the Rosenbach collection and the Lewis collection, are of course now public collections that are available to you all. I want to spend just a few moments, if it won't test your patience too much, showing you some of the letters, and again I'm going to apologize in advance for their fuzziness because they are largely carbon copies of letters.
This is the beginning of Rosenbach's writing cover letter. We're sending you the panel volume. You stand in a slightly different place. Apologizing for sending them before he had a chance to correct them, and noting that they had certainly intended to have this done. Lewis writes back, "I was very sorry to have to ask you to reprint my preface." Well, he wasn't satisfied with the apology. "I did not give the copy to a boy, but to a young man, and told him particularly that I wanted to see a proof of it. As set up, the article was in one place ungrammatical." This is the first piece of correspondence Lewis sends to the Rosenbach Company. So you can see these sort of shaky beginnings. I have to figure out where the sweet spot is for this remote, because it doesn't seem to want to listen to me in all places. The Rosenbach Company writes to Lewis in his capacity as president of PAFA. They want to sell things to the Academy of Fine Arts. That wish is quickly granted, an invoice sent to them and paid by the Academy. Now Lewis is writing about another purchase. We don't know anything else about this purchase. "But could you let your cabinet maker come to this office and putty in with brown putty the glass of the clock face, which is simply held in place by a couple of brads? Have you got the key of the clock? I was rather surprised at the condition in which the clock was sent." So, some problems early on, but there's a gap of about 10 years in the correspondence. And then we see letters where the Rosenbach Company is writing, saying, "We're buying this for you, we're offering this to you. Here are things he bought and things he lost at auction." And again, assuring him, Lewis, that Rosenbach had looked carefully at the miniatures in particular, meaning the leaves, the cuttings, to make sure that they were in good condition, and where they weren't, he would not buy them. The collection of Persian and Indian manuscripts begins almost immediately. By the early 20s, he's inviting the Rosenbach brothers to come and look at them. They're on display at the Academy, interesting to note. No conflict of interest there. This is the letter in which Lewis says, "I do not care for full manuscripts, because the purpose of my collection is for exhibition at the Academy of Fine Arts, and deals with the exhibition from an art standpoint only, not a library point of view." And I think that explains how the whole collection of leaves got built. This is the kind of letter we have a lot of. "Buy me lot number 405 for $650, but if your buyer likes the look of it, go up to $1,150. That's twice the bid. He really trusts this man. Wonders why no commission is being charged on these purchases. Clearly, the Rosenbachs are making money somehow. This is one of the letters that shocks me, because even as his taste is getting more sophisticated, he asks them to buy a number of items. "I leave their purchase entirely to your judgment. I have not seen them, and my bids are merely guesses." The Rosenbachs write back, and they tell him things like, "This one, very bad condition, doubtful origin, obviously a fake." And to the extent they share with him their doubts, they're building trust. Lewis comes to regard them as a very good source. And he turns over ever larger commissions to them. "Kindly advise me if you bought any of the illuminations from the Holford Library. I hope that I bought some at least, as I bid on the entire 46 items." "I am more than pleased with the way in which my bids have been handled. Your buyer in London seems to me to have very sound judgment." So again, this trust exists. Now we're seeing Lewis at his diffident, or his mean side again. "I would like to have a quorum at the next meeting of the Council of the Historical Society, and if you can conveniently be present, I would be greatly obliged." Why is that mean? Obviously, Dr. Rosenbach accepts the invitation and goes. The next letter: "Thank you very much for your helpfulness at the meeting. I think that Mr. Spofford will make a good working librarian, and probably more than that at the present time we cannot expect." 1930, the first letter in which he tells the doctor he wants to give his collection to the Free Library. And now there begins the whole process of appraising his collection. Letters back and forth talking about things that have been purchased, but also things that have been appraised. And increasingly, the purchases diminish, the appraisals are taking place. He's putting his collection in order for transfer. This is part of that appraisal, simply a type list in which the doctor, in his own handwriting, has added the values. That would not fly with the IRS today, but back then it was just fine. This is a letter in which the cuneiform tablets are mentioned. 1930, "There is no hurry whatsoever with reference to your appraisal of the prints I am giving the Free Library, but in fact he exerts quite a good deal of pressure on him." Goes on to talk about how it's not necessary to work hard on this, because after all, they'll be given away and not being sold. More letters documenting purchases, as well as things not purchased, which the company felt it important to continue emphasizing. As late as 1931, he's still buying fragments and clay cylinders, stipulating those prices. He mentions on occasion reference books that he wants the company to purchase for him. There's a level of service that's almost surprising here. The appraisals are finally completed. This is a letter in which the Rosenbachs now offer "Hey, there's a sale coming up. Can we buy anything for you?" "Thank you, but the description in Sotheby's catalog was so insufficient that I could not make even a partly intelligent bid." That's the last letter we have from Lewis Sr. This is Lewis Jr. writing some months later to say, "Please come and appraise father's estate." By letter of instruction, he has instructed us to give many of his collections to the Free Library. So again, this emphasis throughout. This correspondence talking about how and when to do the appraisals and the importance of having lunch out there when we do so. This to show you that even good collectors who create public collections are sometimes butchers of manuscripts, to use that word again. "Dear Doctor, just for your information, I found what have the Douglas manuscript. Walter Lowenfels, who got it from Douglas and who sold it to the Holiday Bookshop, found it to be overweight to mail cheaply from Mars. And wishing to save postage, he took a razor and split it in the way that you saw." The collection begins to attract more public notice. De Ricci is inquiring about the manuscripts. He's not able to see everything yet because the estate hasn't been completely settled. And the appraisals begin to come in. Lewis is relying on Rosenbach to appraise everything and sometimes to find certain things. Couldn't find the book that he wanted. Rosenbach finds it. So again, this high level of service for a family that had been for customers. Some of the appraised manuscripts can now be turned over to the Free Library. Lewis Jr. notes that he and his wife have selected a couple of things to keep, and the rest will go to the Free Library. Those are still in the Lewis family, which is wonderful to know. It's several generations of collectors. It's also where Lewis Jr. urges Rosenbach to select one of the Persian or medieval manuscripts or medieval things for your own use, and I hope that it will be among the best of the lot. Almost unheard of generosity. This was the manuscript Dr. Rosenbach suggested. This is one of two manuscripts I will show you today of mid-1560s Italian deposition Apollonio de Bonfratelli. Very colorful. The doctor himself was not really a collector of medieval manuscripts, and it's kind of hard for me to figure out why he chose this piece, particularly as an observant Jew. But this is the one he chose, and we do still have it in the collection. Now Lewis is wondering, hey, where's that appraisal? I need this. It comes the next day, the cover letter, and the list. And I've made just a few slides of things. This is the first page and the second. And you can see that it runs the gamut of objects. Now we move somewhere farther down. Number 758 is where the library starts. We go through some of the library. And later, up at 971, we get to the second floor library. You'll see the number of miniatures and illuminations that are mentioned in that library. You also see the kinds of things that drive you crazy as a scholar. Miscellaneous books, 50 volumes. You won't be able to identify those in the future, I don't think. But again, this goes on for pages and pages and pages. This is the list of books that Rosenbach then purchased. Sorry to say, none of which is still in our collection. But perhaps it gets tracked down at some point. And I wanted to close with this image. This is one of the Lewis leaves, and this is an early Italian illumination, 1315 or so. It's Neri di Rimini. Rimini, or Neri, rather, was interesting as an illuminator because it wasn't his original profession. He was a notary and later became an illuminator. And with this background in the law, he was one of the first illuminators to sign his work. Lewis, with a legal background like him, also signed his works. And I mentioned earlier that he would add his full name to almost every leaf and manuscript he bought. You see a nice example of it there, and the little blue speck is the stamp that he would apply and add his device on it. This is a close-up, which is not very well focused, but you can see the signature and the stamp. And as I say, the great thing about the Lewis collection is not just that it's available in Philadelphia in the flesh, but it's also available online everywhere. So, it's a wonderful victory for Philadelphia. Thank you.
So, questions, Brother Derek, Brother James.
Any questions that you have?
And what? Yes.
Who is the buyer of the money?
I don't know him by name, but that's something that could be found out.
I think whether it was directly or through Rosenbach, I'm not sure. My suspicion is that Trump sales were directly.
I'm sure that's right. In fact, the company sometimes maintained that they had offices in London, Paris, Budapest, and other places. They did not. They worked with other dealers for office services.
Yes, Bill.
Hi, Derek. I would note that Lewis's collection did get into the catalog. We got, over 10 years ago, inquiries all the time about particular DiRici numbers. And I think, can you search now by DiRici numbers in the present?
No. they're there, but you can type in the number, but it's not guaranteed.
But when people find a DiRici number, it is findable.
Yeah. We're working on
that. They don't say free library always, they say collection of soundtrack in DiRici.
I just wanted to ask, do you think that it's possible to correlate your business records with the actual Lewis manuscripts that we now have at the Free Library?
Absolutely.
To say he paid someone for it, he got it on so-and-so a day, that came from so-and-so a sale, but there's a further provenance back. Has any of that been done?
And also, he writes in his manuscript quite a bit of how much he paid for each one and gives the details.
He writes them on the manuscript.
Yeah, Lewis
also wrote a code into the front of everything we sold that had the price they had paid. We can translate that code. But again, we have the records for every customer they had. So I was trying to get at Lewis's motivations as a collector and not track down specific manuscripts, but that could absolutely be done.
I appreciate that the conference is mostly about Western manuscripts today, but in trying to understand his motivations for purchases, does the correspondence throw any light on his interest in Oriental?
It's mentioned time and again by this Persian manuscript for me, but not why. I don't know why that Eastern event comes about. It may have been, and I'm guessing here, his sense of being an outsider in this world of collectors and wanting to move into an area where nobody was at.
But as a follow-up, Robert Garrett was collecting at the same time, and was part of the motivation of some kind of competition going on?
Garrett's name is never mentioned. And again, I think Lewis saw himself as an outsider. He was the inside as an outsider. He had all the money and status he wanted, but he never felt that he was connected with these others.
Who was the director of the Penn Museum who was so
here? Harrison, I think was his name at the time.
Can you tell us what books didn't get into the Rosenbach? I mean, how that divide took place? There's so many books that you talked about don't end up in the Rosenbach. Where did they go?
Sure. Well, they go lots of places, and you have to remember that the Rosenbach brothers were dealers. Their job was to buy and then resell books and manuscripts. So we sometimes joke about the collection today that we preserve two things, the treasures that they wouldn't sell and the junk that they couldn't sell. their eyes were not unerring, and we bought things you wonder about from time to time. But, of course, they sold the vast majority of things. I'll give you a literary example. We have 2/3 of Joseph Conrad's manuscripts, but we don't have Heart of Darkness, which they sold to the Binding King. And they had a long fight about whether it should be sold or not. The doctor wanting to retain it because he liked Conrad. Philip saying, we got to run the business, sell something.
I just wanted to make a comment, Derek, that we do have the cuneiform tablets of Lewis, and he actually bought us display cases for them with drawers that they're contained in, and he bought them so that we would have a place to store them. And in correspondence I've seen, he is actually bringing them into the library, and the librarian writes, Mr. Lewis came in today with 5 tablets, and he would like me to display them. So these are, the beautiful display cases, and he knew a lot about them too, and he would write that, why are you trying to sell me more of the seals? They are like a dime a dozen.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. I think some did get transferred to Japan. It was Lewis's grandson who told me that it was basically a spite gift, and he didn't think the Free Library wanted the things.
Right.
Who knows? Well, thank you all for your patience. That kept you from lunch, Mark.
So thank you, Peter, and thank you for those wonderful papers. It's been a great morning session. I have 2 things to say before everyone takes off. We have some eye candy for you at the Arthur Ross Gallery. The Treasured Pages exhibition is open. And then also in the Lee Library in the back, the manuscripts that have been recently purchased at Penn for you to see. Also, another note of business, if you don't know where to eat on this campus, the staff here has left a list of places with directions somewhere on that front table, I understand. So if you're looking for somewhere to eat, there is that. So see you back at 2:00.